historical hindsight, how often are men blindly led into battle, motivated by national pride, while remaining ignorant of the actual circumstances and the cost? How often has the world been led into war by well-intentioned, foolish leaders, whether by imperial rule, dictatorship, or even democracy, only to learn they were wrong, dead wrong? Who pays the price, the ultimate price? The battlefields of history are littered with those who pay that price with their lives, their limbs, their sanity, including innocent civilians, wherever the line is drawn, the youth of nations killed off. And for their loved ones, they will never again share the light of day with their sons, husbands, brothers, cousins, and boyfriends. In the end, World War I can only be embraced by a temporary peace and armistice agreed to when the expenditure of life and the cost of financing such a pursuit were determined by the powers to be expendable no more.
Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Dan Irving is a retired business broker, missionary, historian, and author of Don't Expect Luggage to Arrive. His second book, Heart of the Poppy, is a 100-year true story that starts in the trenches of the Western Front during World War I. Dan Irving, welcome.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You know, the title of your book is Heart of the Poppy, and I'd like for you to read a poem that you reproduce in your book, if you would, and tell us who wrote this poem.
This poem is by Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, who was a Canadian who actually died during World War I. And he wrote a famous poem called In Flanders Fields. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
This poem is one that I have liked for years, and this he ends with, "We shall not sleep though poppies grow in Flanders field." And you also, in your book, tell us why that flower is symbolic.
A flower is very important to the history of World War I, which really was also World War II, and I'll read from the book. The landscape was devastated from the bombings. All vegetation, trees, and growth were annihilated. What was left was a ground covering of death and destruction, potted with all sizes of craters. It truly was no man's land. Nothing here could survive the constant bombardment of industrial explosions of every kind known to man. Amazingly, out of this chaos, something would spring forth. Something which would come to symbolize the horrific conflict, a flower, a bright, dark red flower, the poppy. Fields of poppies sprouting up into life throughout the fields of death and destruction, a simple, red, passionate flower representing all the blood spilled, yet vibrant enough to overcome the death and destruction and offer hope in a new life.
This is author Dan Irving reading from his newest book, Heart of the Poppy, From War to Amour. And you, in your regular life, before you began doing what you do now, you were a business broker, you a missionary, and I mentioned that, but now you are an historian. And I was amazed at the history I learned in your book, Dan. I think about all that I had encountered in history books was that World War I began when the Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated. But you go into detail that my jaw dropped every page I read in this opening chapter of your book. So I would like you to tell How did you get started researching the history of World War I?
That's interesting. I didn't start off to write this book, but I did have some things happen in my life that took me to Belgium and took me to Poperinghe, where a lot of this occurred, and also to London. And I had known some people from my past who are now deceased who had fought in the war. And I just started putting pieces together, and I started writing about it for a nonprofit organization in Southern California called the Moore Ministries, who thought they were created in 1980. And I started looking at the connections and the roots, and I'm thinking, their roots and connections aren't 1980. It's actually 1914 from World War I. And when I went and I approached—
And that was not generally known.
Nobody knew. Nobody knew. And when I went and I approached them with the evidence that I had, the CEO, Scott Condon, and his wife, Gayla Condon, I told them what information I had about their history. They became fascinated. And this book was really written for them. They do they build houses for the poor throughout the world in third world countries. And now this book is part of their history, and they're giving it to all kinds of people throughout the world to see how God—
Your new book.
This new book, Heart of the Poppy, is now being distributed in England, in Australia, in Belgium, in South Africa, and throughout the United States and in Canada, because there's so much history here that connects all these people and all these events from the war forward. So this book is really a 100-year story, and the subtitle is From War to Amore.
And Amore, again, you might mention this organization that you've traced their history that they didn't even know about.
They had no idea. When I first went to them, they didn't know me, and I told them why I was coming, and I think they thought I was a bit nuts.
But in a good way. You proved that you were nuts in a good way.
Well, that was many years ago, and now we've become great friends. And as a matter of fact, the ending of the book where we have the epilogue, the CEO of Amore wrote the epilogue for the book.
My guest is Dan Irving, and he has become a historian and researched the background of this organization, that background that was unknown to them. You open your book, the first chapter is the Western Front. And I think most people have an idea of what is meant by the Western Front. But speaking for myself, my idea of a World War I soldier is pretty limited, perhaps to Colonel Potter in MASH, when he would put on his World War I uniform or get on his horse. And you say the U.S. didn't even have a cavalry at the outbreak of World War I.
At the time, President Woodrow Wilson was not interested in entering what he called Europe's war. We had an army, a standing army, not very well-trained soldiers of maybe 100,000, and we had about 10,000 well-trained Marines. And this was nothing compared to the amount of death that was occurring on the Western Front. Now, imagine the Western Front during World War I was 475 miles of trenches long. And both sides were entrenched in these trenches for 4 years. They lived.
And all this was before the United States entered the war. So I'd like you to go back to before the U.S. entered the conflict, and you start off with a sentence, you're going to die. It feels as if your death will arrive at any time, within minutes, days, weeks, perhaps months. It appears inevitable and inescapable. Your job is to kill. You watch your friends be killed. You watch them suffer and die while you spend endless days and nights in fear of being killed yourself. When you read that, you wonder, how did anybody who survived not be overwhelmed with what they called at that time shell shock?
Yes, today we call it post-traumatic stress syndrome. But these men that were bombarded daily, and you had these battles that went on for months in this area of the book, which is a salient. And a salient is an area that's bulging land into a particular area. And what happened was, as Germany overran Belgium and into France and in their grand scale to get to Paris, One area of sovereign Belgium soil was held onto by the British, and it was a place called Ypres or Ypres, and they would not let go. And four of the major battles of the war, including Passchendaele, were fought here. Now, we're talking battles that in one day, 20,000 soldiers would be killed. And they held on to this throughout the war, and it just became a historic stand for the British and the French and all the other countries that were involved, including the Americans when we finally arrived, which really was the crux of how the war ended.
Well, you say this imaginary person you're quoting, you would prefer a merciless bullet to the brain. It would be quick and painless. For now, this is your home where the mud and blood flows together in the trenches on the Western Front. And I haven't dug many holes in my life, but I know it takes a long time if you've got a shovel to dig a hole. And I just tried to imagine how the work, the hours, the man hours that went into digging these extensive trenches. You just said how long it was. And you say you learned to live underground with rats the size of cats, only to surface when you're told. Told when to attack and kill or be killed. And you live in waiting, always waiting. It's cold, it's wet, it's unbearably hot, and at times it snows. And you talk about the critters that are down in these trenches. How did you learn how horrible this was?
Well, again, when I was growing up, I knew a person who was with the first American Expeditionary Forces that went to World War I with the Aviation Corps before the U.S. had entered the war. So I knew a bit about it then. And then again, it's research, it's studying, it's reading, it's going back there and talking to people. What's amazing about this field of mud and blood is to this day, on a weekly basis, they have patrols that still go out on weekends that are paid for by the government to dig up the unexploded ordnances that still sit in the mud that could go off. When we talk, this was an industrial era that had just come about. When we talk about a war with bombardments, you're talking maybe 6,000 artillery guns lined up and then fired consistently for 3 days in a row on top of these men on the front. Just bombardment, complete bombardment. But I don't want the book to sound like the beginning of Saving Private Ryan because
– No, but you know, I understood this unexploded ordnance when you point out how thick the mud was. So it just lands in that mud. It doesn't explode. And I hadn't thought about the fact that, yeah, today – there's still unexploded ordnance in the mud, in the dirt,
yeah,
in the ground there in this area.
It's one of the hazards for the farmers over there, agriculture. You could be plowing up a field and come across an ordnance, and you'll be a statistic. But again, from this devastation of World War I, some really remarkable things happened, and that's where the story goes. It talks about the war and the history of the war.
And the cause of it, because, I just knew about the assassination of the Archduke. But you go back to a treaty, 1878, Treaty of Berlin, agreed upon by the United Kingdom, Austria-Hungary, France, Germany, Italy, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire. And it transferred control of Bosnia-Herzegovina to multi-ethnic Austria-Hungary. And this made Austria-Hungary's southern neighbor, Serbia, mad. And it wanted to get together with fellow Serbs in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So this area has been in turmoil since 1878, before that. And then you say what triggered World War I. And what was that?
What triggered World War I, it was actually a terrorist group called the Black Hand, and they had conspired to assassinate the Duke, the Ferdinand, because they felt that he was going to be against him. He was in line to become the king, and so they wanted to assassinate him. And it was really a stroke of fate.
Yeah, because when I was reading this, I always assumed a lone assassin shoots a gun, and that does away with the Archduke. But it was more complicated than that.
Much more.
And it was a fascinating story. Tell us what happened.
Well,
the black terrorist group.
This terrorist group had set up to assassinate. They had planned. They knew that the Duke was coming to do a military parade and inspect troops. And they kind of figured out his route. And they positioned themselves along the route with grenades and pistols. So when the time came that they could kill the Duke. And at one point on the parade, the chauffeured limousine that the Duke was in, they threw grenades at him. And the Duke saw it coming. He actually blocked them with his arm, and the grenades rolled off and blew up and actually injured some of the dignitaries in his party. And they rushed off with the Duke, and they went away from that. And there it goes. They weren't successful. However, later on in the day, the chauffeur got lost, ended up in a cul-de-sac, and was turning around. And there was one of the Black Hand terrorists, Gamarilo Precept, and he saw the Duke. He wasn't prepared for this. The plan went south, and he saw him and did not hesitate. He drew out his pistol and shot and killed the Duke and his wife, Sophie.
So this really was going to be a failed attempt.
It was.
When you see why they just flubbed it all the way around. And then just by accident.
By accident it happened. And
that
then
was a fluke.
It was. It really was. And then Austria-Hungary felt they had to do something. And so later they declared war on Serbia. But this in reality wasn't just a Balkan war. This in reality was the first domino to hit the other dominoes, because the world had positioned itself, especially in Europe, with Germany and England and France. And at that time, England controlled 25% of the world. And countries were just
The British Empire was vast all over the world. You just said, repeat what you just said.
The British Empire controlled one quarter of the world's population and one quarter of the world's resources. And that meant things like diamonds and gold and silver, and they controlled the routes, the trade routes, or how ships would go. So there was a lot of power positioning. And Germany felt entrapped. And Germany wanted to break away from their isolation, as they put it, and they had been preparing for war. This war was going to happen whether the Archduke got shot or not. It was just waiting for that domino to fall.
That was just the straw that broke the camel's back.
That's correct.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Dan Irving, author of Heart of the Poppy. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. So we have these groups lining up against each other, and you mentioned this Archduke that got killed, and he was embittered by the fact that they weren't happy with his wife.
No, she.
And now that's a story that isn't usually told.
No, royalty married royalty. Recently, we had an exception to that with an American, but she was considered to be
Unworthy.
She was a lady in waiting, I think was her title. Even though she was from an obscure royal family, she was a lady in waiting. And so the royalty at the time did not accept her. And so this was a great embarrassment to the Archduke, and he wanted to lift her up. And that's why when he traveled to other countries and when he went to Serbia, he felt that he could be honored and that she would be treated as she truly should be treated there. And that was one of his things. And he's an interesting character.
Yeah, you say to the Serbians, the Archduke represented a serious threat because he was heir to the throne and believed Slavs should be united, carrying an equal voice with the Germans.
Yes. Yes.
And so his voice would forever doom Serbia, never allowing the Serbs to rise as a great nation.
It was an ethnic. It was a tribal. It was however you want to look at the division of people and tribes and ethnicity. And along with that, you had Germany, and they had their own ethnic pride. And they were ready to go. And once that domino went over, one of the first countries to jump in was Germany, and with a grand push towards Paris.
And you mentioned Queen Victoria was Kaiser Wilhelm's grandmother.
This is crazy stuff. I mean, it really is. So the Kaiser of Germany, who's ruling Germany, he's the eldest grandson of the Queen of England.
Of England.
And how are they related? Because it was royalty. It was monarchy. It was dictatorship. It was not democracy. It was a different type of world in different type of governments and countries and ruled by the elite.
And you say Germany plowed their forces into Belgium. And from the onset, civilians, women, and children were part of the massacre in this, what is called the Rape of Belgium.
They plowed through Belgium, which they thought would be easy. And they also thought getting to Paris would be quick and easy. The objective was to get to Paris, take Paris, put most of their troops back on the trains, go back to the Eastern Front, and then take on Russia. It didn't work out that way. And that's what's incredible about this story is they did plow through Belgium. And they just wiped out and walked right through Belgium, except for this one area, this salient area where the British went in there and said, excuse my French, hell no, we won't go. And they stayed there. And then that's where this story, this incredible story, takes place, is what happens in the Ypres area of Belgium in a town, Poperinghe. And the war, the battles, the soldiers, and then the story of Tubby Clayton.
Well, Germany, this is great. It was a boost to their national pride in Germany at this point.
Well, it is. It was until initially the Germans thought this is great. Look at what we're doing. Look what we've accomplished. They didn't realize when they hit the Western Front in all those trenches that it was a stalemate. And it's very interesting because one of the things that – because Adolf Hitler was with the German army.
And yes. Now, you talk – there he was on the scene. First, you don't tell us who it is you're describing. You talk this dark-haired guy, soldier.
Adolf Hitler was there. And you can see some of his history from World War I and what brought about the continuation of it into World War II. He really did despise the Jews. And at that time in Germany, a lot of the newspapers were owned and operated by Jewish families. And it wasn't that the Jews were not reporting correctly, but when the Germans started to lose and the loss of life became incredible. And Germany only had so many young men that they could throw out to the lines. And then they started extending the age, older men, younger men. The newspapers reported this, and Hitler despised them for it. He thought that was bringing down the country. It was non-patriotic. They were against the country. And this is one of the reasons why he was so opposed to the Jews.
My guest is Dan Irving, and he has written a book, Research the History of World War I. And the title of his book is Heart of the Poppy, From War to Amour. And this trench warfare, just is a stalemate. And there is an incident that is portrayed in commercials on TV that shows the soldiers lined up, but Christmas comes along. And I happen to have a family member who grew up in Germany, and Christmas is so important to her. It is just such a big event. And I didn't realize, I thought we Americans celebrated Christmas. But to her, Christmas was just so special. So when I was reading your book, I thought, wow, yeah, that's true. The Germans, even war, can't stop them from getting the Christmas spirit. Tell us what happened, Dan.
Well, at the beginning of the war, Christmas was right around the corner. And when Christmas came, the soldiers on both lines in trench said, spontaneously, they really don't know how it started, the heck with the war. For today, it's Christmas. We're going to celebrate Christmas. And both sides, through the soldiers, not the commanders, the soldiers threw up a truce, went into no man's land.
Yeah, noticing not the officers.
No, not the officers. When the officers found out later, they implemented certain regulations and rules to punish people. As a matter of fact, when they went back and looked at all the different soldiers that were involved, they separated them and put them into different units. But during Christmas, the Germans and the British and the French, they all got together and they celebrated Christmas. And it started, they think, with the German side putting up small Christmas trees on their line. I think it's the Tannenbaum. And they put those out and they started singing Christmas songs. And then on the other side, which sometimes was only 25 feet away, they started singing Christmas songs and back and forth. And then they said, let's meet.
But now you do make a point too, and this seems realistic, that here, if I'm a soldier sitting in a trench and these Germans say, yeah, yeah, come out of your trenches and let's meet here in the middle. And I think, uh-oh, is this a ploy to just mow us down?
Many thought it was a trap at first. It wasn't. It was unique. Men wanting peace. And what was incredible about it is when the officers found out about it and the newspapers back in London and in France started reporting what happened, they said it didn't happen. They actually started reporting that it's a fraud. It's not true. This did not happen. And until the letters started coming home from the soldiers to their families saying, this was amazing. This did happen. And there's a great film and there's a great book. It's called Silent Night. And it talks about what happened that evening. Unfortunately, after that, the bomb started up again.
You know, I even learned the German version of the song Silent Night.
Oh, my.
And I can imagine that because so many Americans were of German ancestry, that it was easy for them to join along. Even if they didn't know the words in German, Americans sing Silent Nacht, Heilige Nacht in English. So I can just imagine this scene of these two opposing, who were supposed to be killing each other, these two opposing armies that get together and sing Christmas carols.
Yeah, it was a beautiful, and it happened. It's not a fiction. It happened. And when we look at our Christmas traditions, the Christmas tree, the nutcracker, and so many songs that we sing, they come from German heritage. There's such a deep heritage in the German history about Christmas and the meaning of Christmas. And this story of the Western Front and the trenches and how the men said, no, not war today, and they came out, and they played soccer.
Yeah, that you described that in your book. The two were opposing teams.
Right, and they also were able to do something that they couldn't do during the fighting, is they could come out and bury their dead. Because if you had men that had, it was called going over the top, that came over the top out of the trenches and were mowed down, and they're lying out in no man's land, and even some that are wounded, screaming out for help, and there's snipers waiting for you to come out, and they're going to shoot you when you come out to get your mate. So during this, they were all able to come out and bury their dead. And what was incredible is they buried their dead together. So you had the one side helping the other side dig trenches to bury the dead in. So it was a remarkable time.
You know, this reminds me, too, of how the officers are removed from what's really going on. They're not seeing things up close. They don't know how these men are, what they're feeling.
No, I think it was General Haig who commanded the British troops. And here, this is incredible. You had literally millions of soldiers dying during the war. And here's the commander of the entire British Expeditionary Forces. He never once visited the front lines. He never once went to where the battle was taking place. He never once experienced what the war was really like. And it would be amazing because when those bombs were going off, you could hear them all the way back in London, the explosions. These were big artillery guns. They were huge.
Well, you mentioned ordnance. We've talked about these bombs that exploded. But there was something new in their arsenal of weaponry that the Germans used that had not been used before. And what was that, Dan?
Well, it was actually three new weapons that were used, but one of them was gas, chlorine gas and mustard gas, which if you breathe it, it'll actually eat you from the inside out. If you read what it physiologically does to your inside and to your lungs, it's a horrible way to go. So one of the things that they implemented was the gas, which is a foreshadowing, obviously, of what happened in World War II with what they did with gas. They also implemented the flamethrower, and they were also able to calibrate the machine guns in aerial craft to shoot bullets between the propeller blades. So these advances in weaponry, which were all designed for killing, and they did. They implemented gas. And actually, the first time I think they implemented the gas was to a Canadian group of soldiers across the field. And there was problems because for the gas to work, the wind had to be blowing the way you wanted it to blow. And sometimes it would back blow and it would come back and bite you because you were now breathing the gas that you put out there. But the canisters, the massive amount of canisters that they brought was just because of the industrial capabilities that had come about through this time. Was just you look at it and you see it and then they implement it. And it's really almost hard to believe what took place and what those men went through.
Yeah, you mentioned that chlorine gas was used, and you said it caused death by stimulating the overproduction of fluid in the lungs, resulting in drowning from the inside out. 6,000 cylinders, each weighing 90 pounds, containing 160 tons of chlorine gas, were hand-carried to the front lines. That's staggering. And then later they used another gas, phosgene gas, that was deadlier, and then mustard gas. And these are all just, they're so awful. But then Adolf Hitler was paying attention.
Oh, he was. And the use of gas that took place in World War I was just, again, what was going to take place in the concentration camps with the Jews and others that Hitler was going to annihilate. Which to a great extent he did. Interesting story, though, with the Canadians and the gas when it first came. They didn't know what it was. I mean, it's coming at them. They see this phosphorus-colored gas coming towards them. They didn't know what it was. And at first it broke through their lines, but they were brave. And they came back into the gas. They didn't know what to do. It sounds gross. They took their underwear. They urinated in it. And then that's what they use as a gas mask. And they went back and retook the line. Now, that is sheer bravery at the most.
And ingenuity.
Yeah, just incredible. What they did on the spot to retake those lines, because they knew if that line broke through, if they poked a hole in that line, they could go further and further through the line, and they couldn't allow that to happen.
Speaking of underwear, that reminds me, you're chuckling because you know what that brought to mind. There was a group that didn't wear underwear.
Yes, the Scots. And this is a true story, the kilts. Everybody knows about the Scots and their kilts. And there was one, I think he was, I think an Australian or a Canadian, and he was in an ambulance. And he was being taken away, and it was a Scottish ambulance. And he was laying on the floor, and there were all these Scots medical people. And he wanted to verify for everybody. He said, I can tell you, as a matter of fact, from the perspective I was viewing, what they tell about the Scots and their kilts is true. There's nothing up there.
Well, you include these little details in your book that might not be found in the official books of history that we study as school children.
Probably not, but the story about the Scots and their kilts is true. We have eyewitness accounts.
Dan Irving and I will continue our conversation about World War I after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Dan Irving is author of Heart of the Poppy, From War to Amour. When somebody reads your book, they can understand why somebody who survived it would not want to talk about it.
Well, think today we know about post-traumatic stress syndrome. These men were suffering it back then, but they didn't know about it. And actually, a lot of them went back home and they were considered cowards. They were outcasts of society. Yet you could only take so much shelling and bombardment without it impacting you. So there was a lot of suffering, a lot of wounded, a lot of casualties, and about 10 million plus deaths that had occurred during the war. And what's interesting is November 11th is coming upon us, and this is going to be the centennial for the armistice that ended or brought the cessation of hostilities during World War I. Didn't last, but it's right around the corner, and there's going to be worldwide celebrations, and you'll see the poppy throughout, because it's what symbolizes our hope that took place after World War I.
And you say that by the end of 1916, over 1 million soldiers were dead, yet the resolution of the German people remained strong, and in their mind they had something to show for it, because Germany was occupying all of Belgium, with that one exception around that area that you referred to in Ypres. They occupied northern France, Russian Poland. There was a defeat of Serbia and Romania. And so Germany then believed they were winning the war.
They thought they were winning the war. And they led themselves to believe they were winning the war. And they had phrases and things. And although they didn't, the supplies in Germany were running low and the food, and there was a blockade in the, at the sea of bringing, importing in goods that were needed, they were suffering back home. They didn't have shoes. They didn't have food. They didn't have the materials for day-to-day living. And yet they were thinking they were winning the war, so it was all for the fatherland and a lot of patriotic spirit. But they really weren't winning the war.
Well, and then they had all these industrial killing machines that were used for the first time. Tanks, heavy artillery, flamethrowers, submarines and U-boats, underwater boats. And as long as those materials and supplies were provided, those machines would operate just to for death and destruction.
And it was the first time. I mean, you look, go back and you study the Wright brothers and aviation, and it brought – it really came about and was highly developed during the war for purposes. So the first bombs that were dropped from an airplane during World War I were dropped by hand. Later, as they developed more mechanisms to do that during World War I, and the Germans were able to devise a long-distance bomber, it was the first indiscriminate bombing of civilians in England, where the Germans came over with their aircraft and started bombing the English in their countryside.
Yeah, so now the war can extend across the English Channel and hit home, literally,
hit
for
home,
the Brits.
Right, and hit home, and it did, and it did, and it did in World War II.
And these pilots were viewed as heroes.
Okay, that's interesting. If you were a pilot in World War I, your life expectancy was 5 to 10 weeks.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, just telling you, you're not going to last. If you were an officer in the trenches, your life expectancy was about 10 weeks. Because when you went out of the trenches and into no man's land, over the line, as the leader and you blew the whistle, you usually were the first to go. And your life expectancy was very low. People didn't want to advance in rank for those very reasons.
And you were saying the minimum age for pilots was 17?
17.
I mean, these are little kids.
Yeah, 17. And they didn't know anything about piloting. So they thought that if you had a background in horseback riding, you'd probably be a good pilot.
That's what, when I read that in your book, I thought, what? A country background riding horses was considered the best indicator of being a good pilot?
That's what they thought, yes.
And then you do say the life expectancy for rookie pilots was 10 days.
Yeah, they weren't going to last. They get shot down from ground fire or from air fire or from mechanical failure. These weren't highly developed aircraft.
And you know what shocked me is they wouldn't give these guys parachutes.
No, and they gave them a gun with one bullet. And in that gun for that bullet is if you were going down, that one bullet was for you to put that bullet to your brain. And we all know the famous story of the Red Baron.
Oh, yeah. And, oh, yeah. Even you can read Snoopy, and he's the Red Baron.
Right, the Red Baron. And actually, the Red Baron, who was an incredible pilot, had the most kills than anyone else, was actually shot down by ground fire.
Which is an unglamorous way to go for such a hero.
Right.
And rule the skies.
Rule the skies. But he was a marked target. He had a three-wing aircraft. It was painted red. So it was not hard to pick him out in the sky. And he survived so much. He was an incredible pilot. When he actually found out about what was happening behind the scenes with Germany and why they were there and what they were fighting, he really wasn't a happy camper. But he was very patriotic, and he was going to do his duty.
Well, the glamour of being a pilot and flying these new machines through the air, and you were saying he had 80 kills to his name when he was finally shot down by rifle fire. And this German slaughter in the air continued until the Allies occupied the synchronized technology, copied, that is. They copied the synchronized technology that you mentioned earlier, that's how the Allies started doing better.
Right, because you could mount your machine gun straight in front of you and shoot right through the propellers, whereas before you couldn't. They had to be mounted to the side, so you couldn't get the enemy in your crosshairs. But think about it, those propellers going so fast and shooting right between the blades, and it was a simple mechanism of a gear and a lever that went to the gun. And once that happened, it changed how pilots were able to kill and shoot and fire their machine guns.
Yeah, I find it surprising anybody could even envision such a concept that you could shoot in between the propeller blades.
Yes.
That amazed me when I read about that. And you said it was the fighter pilots who became the symbols and heroes of the war, with more than 50% of the 22,000 trained British and German pilots becoming casualties.
The survival rate wasn't great. This is the beginning of aerial combat and aviation and landing. Sometimes they didn't have enough fuel, and you'd have to land in the middle of trees or somewhere else. But no, aviation was a dangerous part of the war. It was romanticized, and it really didn't impact the direction of the war, but it became a part of the war. And look how much aviation has advanced since, say, 1916, 1918. And look where we are today.
My guest is author Dan Irving, and his book is Heart of the Poppy, From War to Amour. And you say in your book, we mentioned this advance for the time technology, but when the war started, armies were more like the Napoleonic age, and with horses and mules pulling the equipment. And you say the Britain called up 165,000 mounts for their cavalry, and these other had lots of horses. In all, the ratio of horses to men throughout the war was one horse for every three men.
Their horses were, they don't keep statistics on dead horses, but from the Napoleonic War and the age, horses were pulling carts, they were pulling supply wagons, everything wasn't automated. There were millions of horses that were used and millions of horses that were killed. But horses played a great part of the war on all sides.
So it was rather authentic that in the episode MASH, the TV series, Colonel Potter, they know that they give him a horse that's going to warm his heart because he was so fond of his horse in the war. And so that's a realistic touch.
It is. It happened. And horses were very much part of the war.
Now, something I found interesting, too, was that the Lusitania, there was an American ship, the Lusitania, and we as a country lied about
it. We just found this out recently, yes.
We don't lie, Dan.
No.
We're the United States.
Well.
What did we lie about?
Oh, boy, Nancy. The Lusitania was sunk by German U-boats. And they claimed at the time that the reason they sank it was because it was carrying war supplies. Of course, we denied it. Wilson denied it. And recently—
So how dare they sink a passenger ship, Dan?
Well, yeah, and how dare they put passengers on a war supply ship? And it was recently when they were doing some underwater excavation, they went to the Lusitania and they found, indeed, there were war supplies on this ship. But it was the sinking of the Lusitania and the Zimmerman cable that brought America into the war. Again, we wanted to stay out of war. We weren't prepared for war. It's Europe's war. So the sinking of the Lusitania, and then Germany sent a cable that was intercepted by British Secret Service that was known as the Zimmerman telegram. They sent it to Mexico, asking Mexico to get involved in World War I and come and retake the land that was theirs, and they would help them and take California and take Oregon back and take Washington and the Arizona and the other states and Texas that they should be theirs. And we saw what Germany was doing, the sinking of the Lusitania, and that was what brought about our declaration of going into the war. We never joined the Triple Entente, which was the British, the French, and the Russians. We came in on our own. But now imagine this war is going on, and the one non-expendable resource that was there on both sides, on all sides, was soldiers. They had decimated their supply of young men. America enters the war, but now we have to spend about a year training soldiers. And once we started getting involved in the war, this is incredible. And I think Germany, once they saw this, they said, oh my gosh, we were sending 10,000 soldiers a week. Their soldiers had been, the best of their youth had been killed off. And now America joins. And
well, then one factor too then, that I hadn't thought about in our entering the war, is that Germany wanted to bring the war to our back door by getting Mexico involved.
Exactly.
And so that then does spur us on. I mean, because I thought, I hadn't thought about that as a factor in our decision, this United States decision to enter the war.
Now, the Zimmerman cable and the sinking of the Lusitania was really what brought us in, although we were being prodded by England all along. Please enter the war. And what we are doing is we are saying we're not going to enter the war, but we will send you supplies for the war. And this is Winston Churchill and going back to our diplomatic ties with the crown. And we wouldn't send men. We sent supplies. We ended up sending soldiers. In the end, I think the United States lost about 120,000 soldiers that died during World War I. And we sent well over 1 million soldiers there.
My guest is Dan Irving, and he has researched the history of World War I, and his book is The Heart of the Poppy, From War to Amour. And this, in reading your book, I, for one, as a reader, understood this so much better than I ever did just from the brief, say, one sentence in a history book. And you mentioned that the initial German response to the Americans entering the war was voiced by the Secretary of State for the German Navy. And what did he think about the U.S. entering the war?
Well, he downplayed the whole thing. We weren't considered a factor, although we were a major factor. And there's a great story about American fighting spirit, and we have so much to be proud of. When there was some of our first troops that were sent over were involved and they were moving forward, and the French were in a retreat, and the French were going, go back. You need to pull back. The Germans are overrunning us, so you need to pull back as they were retreating. And the commander for that American group of soldiers that heard this retreat sign was, "Retreat, hell, we just got here." And they actually moved forward and they overtook the Germans. And unfortunately, that commander died in that battle. And for that squadron and that group of soldiers, and they were Marines, I believe, their motto to this day is "Retreat, hell."
Well, this German admiral said, "They won't come because our submarines will sink them."
Well, U-boats did a lot of damage, and it was a factor. They were sinking so many British ships and so many things that were going across the channel. The German U-boats were a real factor in the war, but it didn't change the course of the ending of the war.
Now, this researching of this was because you were familiar with an organization whose roots extend back into World War I. And just briefly then, what are you doing today and what opportunities today do people have to follow your example?
Wow. The message of the book is we start with war. And, you know, how could God allow war in this horrible devastation to occur? But the message of the book, as in the title, Heart of the Poppy, is hope. And it has to do with service towards others, wherever you are. And the characters in this book, Tubby Clayton, Scott Condon, and some of the people that are linked together by the story, they have spent their lives in service towards others. And so I think that's really the message, too, is how can we help our fellow man, our fellow brother, our fellow sister, wherever we are in our own community here in Chico, what can we do? And there's plenty that can be done. It's such a divisive world that we live in, and one side is talking the other side down. And so what's being done? There are things that can be done, but we really need to roll up our sleeves and get out there and try to do what we can right here in Chico with the problems that we have, with the problems of the division, the homelessness, our kids. It's just look around. You'll find opportunities. God will present an opportunity to you where you can come out and help someone.
Well, thank you, Dan, for all that you do and today for writing this book. My guest has been Dan Irving, and his newest book is Heart of the Poppy, From War to Amour. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.